Good. All right. I'm excited about this message this evening, making sense of the resurrection. And it's kind of been the theme title throughout resurrection time is making sense of the resurrection. And resurrection is one of those things that is hard to make sense of. It's such a powerful event. It's like this one great event in the middle of history where Jesus returns to life, and how to make sense of that in the time of Jesus as we join with the disciples in this confusion, this wondering, this kind of figuring out the implications. And now we are here 2,000 years later, still trying to make sense of resurrection, how it influences our lives, how it influences our every day. Because when we look around, when we see the earth, when we see our loved ones passing away, we can't be helped but challenged. What does resurrection mean? What's that future hope when we feel a sense of loss or insecurity or rejection? How do we make sense of the truth of resurrection? So that's the theme we've been considering in Matthew. And we consider it in the first part of John 21, 1-14, the week before last week was the resurrection stations, where we were a little bit more interactive way of doing this. And today we're going to pick up where we left off the week before and talk about Jesus and Peter and how to make sense of resurrection related to this story of Jesus and Peter talking to one another in the post-resurrection time. And if you'll remember from Good Friday, or the story of Peter, that he denied Jesus three times, denied having known him. So this encounter is very important for Jesus and Peter together. So it's actually 1649, not 1648, but I imagine if you're on 1648, your eyes naturally went to the other side. So let's read this together. After breakfast, Jesus asked Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," Peter replied. "You know I love you." "Then feed my lambs," Jesus told him. Jesus repeated the question, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" "Yes, Lord," Peter said. "You know I love you." "Then take care of my sheep," Jesus said. A third time he asked him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt that Jesus asked the question a third time. He said, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Then feed my sheep. I tell you the truth, when you were young, you were able to do as you liked. You dressed yourself and went wherever you wanted to go. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hand and others will dress you and take you where you want to go." Jesus said this to let him know by what kind of death he would glorify God. Then Jesus told him, "Follow me." Peter turned around and saw behind them the disciple Jesus loved, the one who had leaned over to Jesus during the supper, and asked, "Lord, who will betray you?" Peter asked Jesus, "What about him, Lord?" Jesus replied, "If you want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? As for you, follow me." So the rumor spread around the community of believers that this disciple wouldn't die. But this isn't what Jesus said at all. He only said, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you?" This disciple is the one who testifies to these events and has recorded them here. And we know that this account of things is accurate. Jesus also did many other things. If they were all written down, I suppose the whole world could not contain the books that would be written. Backing up just a couple moments, John's resurrection appearances. And John's resurrection or John 21 fits in as kind of an extra resurrection account compared to the other gospel stories. And all what's interesting about the resurrection appearances, they all have their unique character, just like each of the gospels have their unique character, their unique presentation of Jesus in his life and ministry, and their how they're answering the question of who Jesus is and the significance of his life. The resurrection appearances are similar in that way. So just to move to this scene, we have the empty tomb, which isn't really a resurrection appearance because it's just an empty tomb. Jesus hasn't been seen yet. But the people who go to the tomb encounter an angel, and then they encounter this empty tomb. And then we have Jesus encountering Mary where she thinks he's the gardener at first. And then we have Jesus encountering the disciples where he breathes the Holy Spirit onto them. And we have another encounter with Thomas, the empiricist, who needs to touch Jesus, needs to grasp hold of him to verify that Jesus has indeed been raised from the dead. As we consider John 21, this is the kind of outline of the story. The disciples are fishing. They're trying to make sense of the resurrection. They return to what is familiar, what is common to them, and they go out fishing, a time to make sense of what to do next. And Jesus metaphorically lends a hand in their fishing adventure. He tells them to cast their nets on the other side, and they have a miraculous catch of fish. And disciples come ashore, and then they have breakfast with Jesus. And I think this breakfast scene is very important. It's this calm moment where Jesus just sits with them in their confusion, their wandering, their making sense of it. He just eats with them. He feeds them. He provides for them. And it's after this scene of breakfast that Jesus and Peter have their conversation together. And we're not told how long this breakfast took. I don't know. Breakfast varies quite a bit at my house, depending on whether it is a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or whether it is a Saturday. Those Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday breakfasts are just try to shove a piece of bread in the kids so that they can be nourished enough to make it to lunch. And I will then skip breakfast most of the time, having a cup of coffee. That is breakfast that time of the week. But with Saturdays, we try to slow down and have an actual breakfast meal. Some Saturdays are more successful than others. And I like to think of this breakfast on the shore as that a Saturday type of breakfast, a slow breakfast of bread and then letting it sit there and then eating that bread with cream cheese on it or Nutella, depending on your preference. That's the slow breakfast. That's what I'd like to think about. And in this time, there must be so many things running through Peter's mind in that time. It's the third encounter, we're told by John, that Jesus has appeared to his disciples. But we don't have Peter and Jesus interacting like they're about to interact. And I imagine Peter is filled with, like, I denied Jesus three times. I really want to say, I'm sorry. I really want to bring some connection back to be between us. What do I do? And you can see almost when he jumps out of the boat in that earlier passage and runs to him, he almost kind of just stands there as if he doesn't know how to begin, what the next words should be. And I think when we have difficult conversations, or at least when I have difficult conversations, it's always the first word that is the hardest word to get started in that conversation. And I find that first word really difficult to just. And then once I get started, it's fine, it's all right. I can then deal with the difficult conversation. But that first word is so challenging. So I think I feel Peter's anxiety. I feel Peter's waiting for that moment. And what is great is Jesus takes that first moment, that first word, and addresses Peter. We'll look at that more in a moment. And then we have this closing section with the beloved disciple. And so that's the overall sketching out of the passage, the narratives. And so what do we do with Peter? As I mentioned, he had denied Jesus three times, that he had even known him before Jesus' death. And Peter was often the character who did things first, the one who jumped out on the water, the one who was, yeah, I'll do this. I'm full force, all the way in, type of guy. And so that's the context with which this passage, the denials take place. Just before that, he's like, I will do it. I will follow you, even to death. And Jesus is like, no, you will deny. You even knew me three times before the rooster crows. And that must have been difficult for Peter, very difficult for Peter, as it happens on on that evening where Jesus is arrested and then as he denies Jesus. But Jesus doesn't leave Peter in that situation of a frustration, despair, guilt, anxiety, disappointment within himself. He addresses Peter. And it's that question here, do you love me more than these? Jesus takes the first words and invites Peter into this conversation. And there's kind of two ways to take the "then these" part of this sentence. Do you love me more than any of the other disciples do? And this kind of highlights Peter's elevation of himself in different conversations where he sets himself up as the first one to do things, the first one to go. And so that's one way to understand the "then these" part of the question. The other one is, do you love me more than anything else? Do you love me more than fishing? Do you love me more than life? Do you love me beyond anything else? And I think these two questions are at least echoing one another. And I kind of side a little bit more with the first one. Do you love me more than the other disciples? Almost as being an ironic question where Jesus doesn't, where the fact that Peter doesn't engage in the answer of comparing himself to the other disciples highlights that he's learned something throughout this, throughout the death and resurrection of Jesus in his denial of Jesus. Part of this process, a narrative of John 21 is a connection to the previous stories that have happened in the Gospel of John. And what it highlights is that Jesus doesn't leave Peter in his despair and his frustration. What he does is he says, Peter, the journey that we've been on together, the way that we have lived life together these years, what I've been pouring into you, all that stuff is still true. All that stuff is still valid. I still have hopes for you. I still have a task for you to do. And so there's intentional linkings between this passage in John 21 and the previous stories in John, which highlight that Jesus still has something for Peter. The denials are not the final word. That is not the end of Peter's story with Jesus. And there's almost one key link here between John 18:18 and John 21:9, and it's this charcoal fire. And this word is only used two times in the entire New Testament in these two situations. It's an intentional link, a callback to that the time between the first and second denial of Jesus, where Peter goes to warm his hands, having been cold. The denials, I did not even know this guy, is not the final word in Peter's story. Jesus reminds him, that John reminds the reader, in connecting these two passages, that Peter's story does not end here. Peter once again is able to know Jesus, to express his love for Jesus, his commitment to following after him, to fulfilling the task that he has been learning about throughout the entire journey. Peter's denials are not his final word. And in this, the statement, you are still the one I called. You're still the one that I've been pouring into, the one that I've invited along this journey, the one I'm going to send to continue out this journey, this task that I've been proclaiming in my ministry. Simon, son of John. And it's interesting, at the beginning, in John 1:40, in Peter's call narrative in the Gospel of John to follow in after Jesus, to be on this task, he says, Simon, son of John, and then he gives him the name Kephas or Peter. And it's this address, Simon, son of John, which isn't used throughout the Gospel of John until this point here. Again, it's a callback. You are still the Simon, son of John, that I recognize potential in and that I've invited for this journey with me. And he uses Simon, son of John, in each one of his "Do you love me" passages when Jesus speaks to Peter. It's a callback to that initial call. You are still the one I called, the one that I've invited into this journey. And it's not that it's a beginning again where it just moves back to John 1:40. No, it's this whole process. This is a whole journey where one learns what it means to follow after Jesus. So Peter, in his journey, and especially coming out of this denial thing, would be a more humble, a more aware person about what the task is that he is charged with the call of what it means, or with a better understanding of what the call to follow Jesus means in his life. And so this task is still before Peter. It's an invitation for Peter to complete, the task that Jesus has given to Peter, to proclaim the gospel, to be a leader. The denial is not the end of the story. He's still the one that Jesus called, and he invites him to continue on the task ahead. Perhaps more humble, more aware, more understanding of what that journey is. And I've already mentioned this passage in John 13. This is just after Judas leaves, where Simon Peter asks, "Lord, where are you going?" And Jesus replied, "You can go with me now. But you will follow, you can't go with me now, but you will follow me later." "But why can't I come now, Lord?" he asked. "I'm ready to die for you." Jesus answered, "Die for me? I tell you the truth, Peter, before the rooster crows tomorrow morning, you will deny three times that you even know me." This "follow me," it's actually echoed twice in the passage. This "follow me," it's an invitation once again for Peter to follow after Jesus. So what Peter wanted to do, what Peter desired to do, but he wasn't yet strong enough to do. Jesus says, "These dreams, and this longing for you to truly follow after me, do it now. Do it now." It's opportunity once again to complete this task, what Peter longed to do. It is not the end of his story. It's not the end of his journey. He's still the one that Jesus has called. He's still the one who is invited to follow after him. He's the one that Jesus restores, the one that Jesus sends out. And this is good news. It's not the end of Peter's story. Think of the question, "Do you love me?" And I think this question is the human question, I guess, as I've titled it. It's a question that I think we wrestle with in our lives. I know it's a question that I wrestle with. And it's not like that I'm just sitting there all the time, "Am I loved? Am I loved? Am I loved?" But through other questions, the anticipation of what the answer could imply, I think this question informs the background of those questions. We all desire to be loved, to know that we are liked, to know that we are understood, to know that we are cared for. And what this means, this kind of question of love, is unique to each one of us as individuals, the things that we hold as significant, the demonstrations of what it means to be loved. I think this is a universal question of who we are as we sit. We want this security, this safety, that we are loved individuals and loved people. And so many situations in life and the pressures of life and the relationship dynamics that encounter us call into question our status as those people who are loved by God. And can easily, these questions can seep into our souls and distract us and bring us down. And sometimes it's like Peter's story, where Peter's actions to deny Jesus allowed that situation to come into question for him, and to wonder, am I still the one that Jesus has called? Has the denials ruined this relationship? Am I still able to take on this task that I'm about ready to take on, and I long to take on? I've even declared I'm ready to take it on. Has it ruined all these things? But Jesus breaks into this story, and by this interaction, this question, "Do you love me, Peter?" He draws Peter into the story and assures Peter that he is still the one that that Jesus called. He's still the one that is invited into this task. He's still the one that Jesus has been working, and he is still loved. Throughout this Easter season, starting with Lent, we went through the temptations of Jesus and invited you to read, if you wanted, the book In the Name of Jesus by Henry Nouwen. And Henry Nouwen's book, and I have a picture of him. I always have serious pictures of people. I thought, I found this one of him on a skateboard, so that's cool. he already looks better at skateboarding than I am. I cannot skateboard. All right. The temptations of Jesus is the framing part of this book. But the encounter that Jesus and Peter have is the other side of that book, that other side of the story. And the temptations that Nouwen highlights, that he engages with, the temptation to be relevant, the temptation to be spectacular, the temptation to be powerful. And this is what Jesus is confronted with in in the temptations in the wilderness. And these, I specifically want to focus on the dynamic and the answer of the being loved dynamic that Nouwen addresses. And it's quite a long quote, so I will put the PDF online if you want to go back to it. But I'm going to read the section that is from the relevance to prayer section. And the subsection is the question, do you love me? And I think Nouwen's wrestling with this question of love, brings home the point quite well for us in our Christian journey, and provides a good overall arc of making sense of the resurrection, making sense of how these stories fit together all the way through the temptations of Jesus into the restoration of Peter. So, Henry Nouwen. Before Jesus commissioned Peter to be a shepherd, he asked him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these others do?" He asked him again, "Do you love me?" And a third time he asked, "Do you love me?" We have to hear that question as being central to all our Christian ministry, because it is the question that can allow us to be at the same time irrelevant and truly self-confident. Look at Jesus. The world did not pay any attention to him. He was crucified and put away. His message of love was rejected by a world in search of power, efficiency, and control. But there he was, appearing with wounds in his glorified body to a few friends who had eyes to see, ears to hear, and hearts to understand. This rejected, unknown, wounded Jesus simply asked, "Do you love me? Do you really love me?" He, whose only concern had been to announce the unconditional love of God, had only one question to ask: do you love me? The question is not how many people take you seriously, how much are you going to accomplish, can you show some results, but are you in love with Jesus? Perhaps another way of putting the question would be, do you know the incarnate God? In our world of loneliness and despair, there's an enormous need for men and women who know the heart of God, a heart that forgives, that cares, that reaches out and wants to heal. In that heart, there is no suspicion, no vindictiveness, no resentment, and not a tinge of hatred. It is a heart that wants only to give love and receive love in response. It is a heart that suffers immensely because it sees the magnitude of human pain and the great resistance to trusting the heart of God, who wants to answer consolation and hope. The Christian leader of the future is the one who truly knows the heart of God as it has become flesh, a heart of flesh, in Jesus. Knowing God's heart means consistently, radically, and very concretely to announce and reveal that God is love and only love, and that every time fear, isolation, or despair begin to invade the human soul, this is not something that comes from God. This sounds very simple and maybe even trite, but very few people know that they are loved without any conditions or limits. This unconditional and limited love is what the evangelist John calls God's first love. Let us love, he says, because God loved us first. 1 John 4:19. The love that often leaves us doubtful, frustrated, angry, and resentful is the second love. That is to say, the affirmation, affection, sympathy, encouragement, and support we receive from other parents, teachers, or receive from our parents, teachers, spouses, and friends. We all know how limited, broken, and very fragile that love is. Because of many expressions of this second love, there is always the chance of rejection, withdrawal, punishment, blackmail, violence, and even hatred. Many contemporary movies and plays portray the ambiguities and ambivalences of human relationships. And there are no friendships, marriages, or communities in which the strains and stresses of the second love are not keenly felt. Often it seems that beneath the pleasantries of daily life, there are many gaping wounds that carry such names as abandonment, betrayal, rejection, rupture, and loss. These are all the shadow side of the second love and reveal the darkness that never completely leaves the human heart. The radical good news is that the second love is only a broken reflection of the first love, and that first love is offered to us by a God in whom there are no shadows. Jesus' heart is the incarnation of the shadow-free first love of God. From his heart flow streams of living water. He cries out in a loud voice, "Let anyone who is thirsty come to me. Let anyone who believes in me come and drink." John 8:37. "Come to me, all you who labor and are overburdened, and I will give you rest. Shoulder my yoke and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Matthew 11:28-29. From the heart comes the words, "Do you love me?" Knowing the heart of Jesus and loving him are the same thing. The knowledge of Jesus' heart is a knowledge of the heart. And when we've lived in the world with that knowledge, we cannot do other than bring healing, reconciliation, new life, and hope wherever we go. The desire to be relevant and successful will gradually disappear, and our only desire will be to say with our whole being to our brothers and sisters of the human race, "You are loved. There is no reason to be afraid. In love, God created your inmost self and knit you together in your mother's womb." See Psalm 139:13. I remember when I was reading through this passage again, that really struck me. And I think that's the center of our question, our wandering, our restlessness is are we loved? And I think with now and with the scripture, with Jesus, with his life and his teaching, that's a resound. We are loved. We are unconditionally loved by God, and that is the center of who we are. That is the center of the gospel. Center of the implications of the gospel message. Jesus is Lord of the world. He's making all things new, and we are loved. We're invited into that opportunity. We're invited into that task. We are loved. And there's so many stories, there's so many narratives around our lives, there's so many things that press upon us which cause us to question that statement. And that's why we come back again and again to the Gospels and are reminded in Jesus that we are loved. Regardless of failures, insecurity, of loss, that remains constant. We are loved. One further connection, and I made this a couple weeks ago, John 6 and John 21. It's the idea of being fed. And the connection to John chapter 6 and 21 is in the feeding of fish to the multitudes as Jesus feeds his disciples. And I think of table fellowship, of sitting around a table together, and that's sitting around the same table gives an opportunity for true conversation, to be truly known with one another, to be reconciled. And so Jesus, first, before he engages with Peter, he feeds Peter. He sits down at the table with him. He draws him into this moment and this encounter. It's an opportunity to be fed. So before Jesus sends Peter out to feed his sheep, he first feeds Peter, he first nourishes Peter, he first brings in a multitude of fish being caught. He first feeds us, he first allows us to know that we are loved before he sends us out to declare that love to the rest of the world. This is how we make sense of the resurrection. That's the truth that I want to in the making sense of the resurrection tonight, that I want to be loud and clear, is that we are loved, regardless of our past failures, of our past mistakes, even apart from our future mistakes, our future failures. We are loved. Despite feelings of loss, insecurity, of despair, anxiety, we are loved by Jesus. All those questions, all that wandering, all that restlessness is answered by the question, "Do you love me?" from Jesus. And it's an invitation to come and to eat and to know that you are loved. And that's what the table is about, what his table fellowship is about, the cross, the bread, the cup, the symbols of Jesus' sacrifice drawn into these symbols. And so each week we are invited into the opportunity to eat and to be known and to be loved by encountering Jesus in this way. Regardless of what our past week looked like, it might not be a week that we're happy with. We might have a lot of unsettlement. We might be tired. We might have anxiety. We have this moment to invitation to come and to eat. Despite what tomorrow might be like, what the events of the next week might be, we're invited to the table to know that we are loved. And that is one way to make sense of the resurrection. And it's always with the table, it's this double call, this double invitation. We come, we encounter Jesus, we are welcomed at his table, we hear once again that we are loved. But like now, and quoting him again, when we live in the world with that knowledge, we cannot do other than bring healing, reconciliation, new life, and hope wherever we go. We are then sent out from this place to declare this love that we have encountered in Jesus.